unclipped from the fixed rope and took a few steps. They were awkward. Not quite a stumble, but enough to be noticed by the others. He was at least a few meters from the fixed line when they started to yell. It was too late. He dropped away. Through the thin air, past the blue ice, a 400-meter fall down the Lhotse face. I had to ask the story from the Sherpa at the helipad a few times. I couldn't believe that anyone could fall that far and survive. It didn't seem possible. The Lhotse face was always known to be dangerous. Sheer walls of blue ice, a gauntlet that the Everest climbers had to run in order to summit. To fall at this point usually meant certain death. I steadied myself. The heli was on approach. Many of the Sherpa had left the helipad and scurried down the rock bank. I was here with a handful of Sherpa and Bruce, an American EMT from one of the climbing teams, all huddled on the ground. The B-3 helicopter roared on approach. The downdraft of air blew the Khumbu dust in great billows. I tucked my chin into my jacket and pressed my goggles into my face. No more time to theorize. It was time to work. After the skids had touched down, the Sherpa that were with me approached the heli and opened the rear door. Many hands lifted the skid from the heli and delivered it to the ground. The patient was still bundled in his down, but it was already easy to see the extent of his injuries. Massive head and facial injuries were visible despite the field bandages that had been applied. He was unconscious, but he was breathing. We hunkered down as the chopper powered up again. With another roar, it was off, up again through the valley. We only had 10 minutes to work. Our rescue heli from Kathmandu would arrive soon. With few words, Bruce and I got to work. We sequentially moved over the patient with gloved hands and completed a primary survey. Airway, patent. C-spine was controlled in a SAM splint. Breathing, equal chest rise and moving air well, no added sounds. Circulation, no massive hemorrhage noted, but there was a controlled scalp wound. No signs that the chest, abdomen, pelvis, or limbs were pooling blood. Disability? I did some quick maths. E1, V2, M1, 4. Not good. Left pupil was sluggish at 4 millimeters. Right pupil wasn't seen. The swelling over the eyelids had sealed it shut from all the presumed facial fracturing. In the next moments, the helicopter could be heard on approach. Shouts. Movement. A hunkering down again as the great machine lowered to the ground. Hands. A hoist of the sked onto the chopper. I followed, my medical bag handed to me just before the heli door shut. A scatter of bodies as me, the pilot, and the dying man, our small Trinity, were carried down the Khumbu Valley, over the tent metropolis of base camp, south towards Kathmandu. I had only one job, keep him alive.
Dr. Dinesh Dionarain is a New Zealand-based urgent care physician whose love of the wilderness was born out of growing up in Canada. Whilst training and working in urgent care, he has also developed skills and expertise in wilderness medicine, and this year saw him being selected as one of three doctors to staff the so-called Everest ER for this season. Situated at 17,500 feet above sea level at the Everest Base Camp, it provides essential medical services for climbers, Sherpas, support staff, and locals in one of the most inhospitable places on the planet. What you've just heard was an extract from his blog, which he's been posting on our college website, rnzcuc.org.nz, and you can hear him read another one at the close of this podcast. I managed to catch up with Dinesh at the conclusion of his 50-day stint on the mountain, whilst he was re-acclimatizing in Kathmandu. We join our conversation as we discuss that miraculous survival of the mountaineer who fell off Everest.
Well, Well, it's interesting. So talking to a lot of the team leaders that have been there for years, if not decades, they said that was the longest fall for someone to survive in Everest. So he fell 400 meters, basically straight off the face of the mountain, and tumbled and kind of rolled at the end of it, but it was pretty well a straight fall.
And does the altitude make a difference from a head injury point of view at that point?
Yeah, so there probably will be some brain swelling. Obviously, with the rapid descent, we're probably able to correct a lot of that just with the descent. So dexamethasone was offered. We were able to give them as initial treatment. However, probably the initial cause of him unclipping in the first place, I'd suspect, was actually confusion. So my suspicion is that he had brain swelling to start, and that actually probably precipitated this train of events, is that he unclipped himself in the line, took a few steps, stumbled around, was confused, and that was a result of altitude swelling, and then had his fall.
It was one of your earlier blogs talked about altitude sickness and the effects of on the physiological effects of acclimatizing and the like. So you've felt the effects of altitude sickness yourself, haven't you?
Oh yeah, more times than I like to remember. It's really interesting at altitude, even at 5,300 meters at base camp, you're standing on top of, you're standing at an altitude that's higher than most mountains in the world. So, when you first arrive there, even putting on your boots is exhausting. your walk to the clinic is exhausting. Let alone anything that has to be done at pace. So I can only imagine what the climbers experience, especially at the altitudes when they're not using oxygen. Super, super challenging.
And did you have to spend a set amount of time before you were allowed to start working clinically to acclimatize, to let your brain get used to thinking at altitude?
That's a really good question, Guy. You'd think that would be the case, but when we arrived there, it was sub-zero temperatures, and obviously we were arriving with just boxes of medical kit, sealed up, and basically there is no medical tent until we set it up. Now, granted, we get a huge help from the outfitting team that's there, so the Sherpa team do help us with the setting up, but the first thing that you do after you've hiked and arrived at base camp, you have a sleep, and the next morning you're up early doing hard physical labor setting up a large MASH style hospital tent. So there was really no rest for the wicked when we arrived, and just the physical challenges at Everest are immense. And even if you're a doctor there, you experience kind of daily physical challenges in addition to the medical challenges that you face.
And you're there as part of the Everest ER. Is that right? That's the name given to the field hospital that you build each season up there.
Yes. Yeah. So it's a standard kind of barrel tent field hospital. It's been given the name Everest ER, and that's names as much historical as anything else, even though the practice that you see daily, the acute, high acuity cases like the one I described there are the rarity. You do see a lot of I would say, cases that are more common presentations that you'd see in urgent care, a lot of respiratory illness, a lot of cuts, scrapes, sprains. It actually forms the bulk of our workload. So that's actually almost in a way more of the scope of what you see. You do have to have some acute skills, because these events like the one I described will happen. They'll happen rarely. And so Everest ER is a name that was kind of given by the founder, whose name is Luann Freer, and she is an American emergency doctor, and felt that it was an emergency service that was being provided, which of course it is, but we do a lot of essentially primary care for the Sherpa people and the porters, and basically urgent care for people that kind of walk in with minor injuries. So it kind of embraces a very large scope, and ER practice, although it bears that name, is just one part of it.
And how is this funded? How are the services paid for?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So basically, it's a Nepali NGO. Everest ER used to function independently, but also as a foreign NGO, but is now being incorporated under the auspices of the Himalayan Rescue Association, and they are Nepali-based and Nepali-run. So one of the mandates that we try to have is a Nepali doctor there as part of the crew, in addition to one or two other Western doctors. So that ratio changed. Usually almost always three doctors, at least one Nepali doctor, hopefully two, and then the remainder of the complement being foreign doctors.
And do you need to be registered there? How did you get to be a part of the team?
Yeah, registration has become a much more important part. There's a lot of foreign aid that comes to Nepal. And in recent years, there actually have been people who have even impostered doctors and taken up jobs with NGOs, both Nepali-based and foreign NGOs. And as a result, the Nepali government has become quite sensitive about these issues. They now require that all doctors that practice in Nepal be registered with the Nepali Medical Council. So that is something that we need to do in addition to our immigration registration and our tourism board registration. There is also the Nepali Medical Council registration. So it does pay for people that are interested in volunteering in Nepal to find out the legal requirements and make sure that your organization is kind of on top of that. Thankfully, the HRA is very sensitive to these matters, and they've been very thorough in making sure that we are credentialed appropriately for the work that we do up there.
One of the striking pictures that you put on your blog that I had seen video footage of this before I saw your blog is the landing that you have to go through in order to get the part of your journey to get to Everest Base Camp. It involves landing at what some people say is the most dangerous landing in the world. The pilots are, there's only a handful of pilots who are allowed to land there. There's no instrument landing system. It's on the side of a mountain. It's high altitude, so certain planes can't fly at that level. And there's mountains and weather and all kinds of things. And it seems a good point to maybe talk about your feelings coming into land at that Lukla airport.
Yeah. I think even a very seasoned flyer will experience a moment of doubt. I think even the faithful will experience moments of doubt on a flight to Lukla or leaving Lukla. It's interesting you mentioned that, Guy, because I did also write a blog. I think it was just the second episode where I was describing this landing into Lukla, and just even looking around at different people's reactions was very, very interesting. And basically, just to summarize it briefly, you have about 300 meters of landing strip. And like you said, planes with no instruments or night flying, having to make a visual field reference landing on this airstrip and having a very, very small margin in which to do it was a really interesting experience. And I had the pleasure, I suppose, of repeating the experience recently leaving from Lukla, which is I would say, even more harrowing experience, because the pitch of the landing strip is about 30 degrees, and you've already experienced where this landing strip begins and ends. So the plane starts off on this strip, and you know that it has only 300 meters to achieve lift. Otherwise, it drops into the valley 2,000 meters. So it's like being on a roller coaster ride where there is absolutely no margin of error. So you just try not to, I suppose the best advice I could say is just try not to think about it too much and trust the fact that some of the Nepali pilots are some of the best in the world for that reason.
Yeah, it makes my palms sweat just thinking about it. And landing there is just the beginning, isn't it? To get from there to base camp, what's then involved from that point on?
Yeah. So I guess another way to think about it, I mean, once you've arrived in Lukla alone, you've practically scaled most of Mount Ruapehu. So that's the elevation you're at. Now, in order to get to base camp, you still have to double that elevation. And you have to do so over the next 42 kilometers. Now, 42 kilometers doesn't sound very much to most people. That's the length of a marathon. But if you were to try and cover that distance in a day, you would probably pass out, if not be in critical condition from the rise in altitude that you achieve over that time. So it has to be done in a very stepwise manner. And usually at that altitude, you try not to do gains over about 500 meters a day, with a day of acclimatization every third day in order to safely achieve your altitude.
And are you carrying medical equipment? Are you transporting the stuff that you're going to create with the Everest ER, or is that all there before you, or is there another way of getting it there, or is it person power?
Just like in the old days, I mean, dating back to the, you know, the Hillary expedition, and even prior to that, the major muscle power is yak and human. So there are huge trains of gear that end up going along that trail towards base camp. So all of our gear was mostly packed, and you do pack your personal gear. I obviously carried a small medical kit. And during our trek, we were the kind of instructors and assistants on a Wilderness Medical Society trek, so a CME trek, which was actually going up to base camp at the time, and we assisted with them. Interestingly enough, we also ended up being sort of the de facto doctors for that trip as well, to treating other doctors who were actually, despite the lectures we were giving them and the cautions we were giving them, still getting altitude sickness.
So that's... If we get to maybe the hospital itself that you were setting up after you made it there, exhausted and suffering a little bit from the exhaustion of getting there, what sort of equipment do you have in your ER field hospital at base camp?
Yeah. So the kit is actually quite basic. The essential equipment, I'll go through that first. I mean, the first thing that you really need is altitude medications. And without going through the long drawn out physiology of altitude medicine, basically the medications that we use, largely the one for acclimatization and treatment of mild to moderate symptoms, is Diamox or acetazolamide. And then the more serious medications we need for cerebral edema are dexamethasone. And for pulmonary conditions, it's the go-to is usually nifedipine to relieve the pulmonary manifestations of altitude. So those are kind of like your three mainstays in terms of altitude medications. There are some other adjuncts that we use. In terms of the other medical kit, anything basically you'd see in urgent care as well too. So you have to be prepared for the cuts, breaks, sprains, that you see, the musculoskeletal problems that you see, the respiratory illness that you see, the cardiac, hopefully minor problems, but we do see major problems as well too. In terms of emergency kit, you do need kind of a reasonably well-stocked bag that can manage airways and simple emergency procedures as well too, as you would see in urgent care as well. And then on the kind of the more sophisticated end of what we have is we actually did have a donated ultrasound from Sonistite, an M Turbo that we used for the season on loan. And that was extremely useful in terms of diagnosing fractures, in terms of diagnosing pulmonary edema versus pneumonia versus other lung pathology. We used it to try to look for abdominal pathology. So we had a great use out of that as well too. So that's kind of like the basic setup in terms of medical equipment as well.
That's fascinating. So an ultrasound really is a huge advantage at because before that you obviously wouldn't have access to any kind of imaging, any kind of blood work. Do you have sort of point of care blood gear or anything like that?
That's been something that has been considered, but because of technical issues with cold, cost, getting equipment there, it's not really a practical option for us. So we don't have blood work diagnostics. So having the ultrasound is a huge boon in terms of imaging diagnostics, but very little in terms of blood work diagnostics, et cetera. So you do have to, and I think this is something that I find really fascinating, you do have to kind of fall back on really those kind of core clinical skills. And I know that's something that's emphasized in urgent care. So you do really have to fall back on those core clinical skills in order to practice well and confidently in these remote environments.
Do you have a defib, presumably?
Well, this became a very controversial thing because there had been, I believe, a defib previously, and that was something that was not supplied either by donation or the funds available for it. So it's become mentioned as a priority. Thankfully, we did not have a situation where we needed to have a defib present. However, we were able to diagnose an ST elevation MI on the field, which required, you know, prompt, obviously, evacuation and maximal medical therapy. But the knowledge of having a defibrillator would have probably made us be a little bit more comfortable in the window that we had to wait
while he was awaiting evacuation.
So you've mentioned that this was set up by an American emergency doctor, and you're obviously an urgent care doctor who works in emergency departments as well. What were the other skill sets available to you in terms of medical staff?
Yeah, so that was very interesting. So obviously my background is emergency and urgent care, and there was myself and the two other doctors that I was paired with were Deirdre McCormick, who is an Irish GP actually, who's practicing now in Australia, and then Pawan, who's a medical officer from Nepal, completing his second year of medical service. So he's still rather junior himself. So that was the team. And interestingly enough, there's not a strict necessity to have a lot of senior doctors as your medical ER team. And I think one of the strengths that Dr. Luann Freer has is actually bringing good teams together. So she looks at the skills that people have and she pairs them and matches them together for a field season. And then the other thing that I believe is one of her strengths is she actually really looks for people's personalities and sees how they will get on along personally and pairs them in that sense as well too, because there's nothing worse than spending 50 straight days in an extreme climate practicing medicine when you know, the people and the personalities are really coming up against each other.
Yeah, when we chatted about your medical sort of journey in the profile that we did of you, you mentioned your involvement with the Mars project over in Nevada. And the astronauts have a similar they have a similar approach to choosing astronauts and teams to go up into space, is that it's all about the teamwork and people have to work together. And I imagine it's pretty similar. Indeed. At the heights that you've been at. It's all well and good knowing things, but unless you work well as a team, you're pretty useless.
Agreed. Yeah. So very similar in terms of selection mentality with that approach, trying to find people who not only have a certain resilience in addition to their skills, but also have the ability to work with others and solve problems as teams is really a critical aspect. You hear the sporting analogy that, you know, if you put too many superstars on a team, it doesn't necessarily guarantee a championship. and often we see that in practice. So realistically in medicine, that often the same adage applies.
Yeah. Famously, I think it was Greece won the European football. They didn't have any superstars, but they beat a lot of the other European teams that were full of all the, you know, people earning $300,000 a week, but they didn't play as a team. So teamwork is, exactly, is important, and it's a very key attribute to urgent care as well down here in the at this altitude.
Agreed. I think at any altitude.
So you've mentioned a case of ST elevation MI, and I've seen the ECG in a picture on one of your blog posts. Would you want to talk about that as a case? Because I imagine that's a pretty difficult case to manage.
That was a very difficult case. There's obviously a lot of variables that come into play when you have severe illness or injury in a remote environment. And it's heightened by the fact that often these cases do come in, you know, middle of the night. And that in the Everest region, that poses the immediate problem that the evacuation is not going to happen till daylight. There is no night flying capability in the Himalayas currently. So immediately from the start, you understand that that is going to be one of the parameters of your management. When we did see the ECG come through on the computer, basically I was working that evening with Pawan, the Nepali doctor, and we just basically stared at each other. And it was just one of those very knowing looks that we shared, knowing that we had a very, very serious and potentially critical case that we would have a lot of work to do. A lot of work really meant maximizing his medical therapy with the knowledge that we had no capacity to thrombolize, no available cath lab,
but knowing that maximizing his medical therapy, including anticoagulation pressure control and reducing the risk of fibrillation, was really the key to saving as much heart and actually saving his life over that night until he had definitive care.
So a little like managing MIs 30, 40 years ago, but pre-thrombolysis, pre-angioplasty. You were going back to basics.
Agreed. Agreed. And it does, I find, stretch your knowledge and skill as a clinician. And I think probably if I were to really admit it, it's probably one of the reasons I do it. Because you'll find that you will not be challenged as much anywhere else than if you take away a lot of kit that you come to rely on day to day and then are forced to be much more industrious with your knowledge, skills, and medication.
And that is, I guess, what we read a lot in the papers here about the sorts of people who go to climb Everest. They are often wealthy individuals who have paid a lot of money to go over there, and they are presumably accepting of this risk that you're going to be unable to be evacuated in the middle of the night, for example. They are accepting that they are not near a hospital. And are the people who are being brought by these companies to ascend Everest, are they being medically screened before they come? Do you have to pass a fitness test before they get to base camp?
That's a very good question, and it's part of a much larger issue, I think, at Everest, and it's something that people that have been following the news this year about Everest are probably aware of, is that there was a record number of permits issued this year, 381 permits, and right now there is no formalized process or strongly formalized process about how those permits are issued and what climbing standards are required for them. And the Nepali government has gone back and forth about putting more stringent guidelines in place and then relax them as well too. Now, people have put some blame or at least focused some attention on the Nepali government for not being more regulatory. But in a country that has still a lot of poverty, the tourism money that Everest draws is something very significant to the economy. And to try and stem that is obviously contrary to their fiscal interests. So I can see why they have a particular focus of being permissive. It also takes the attention away from the organizations, in particular the foreign organizations and the Nepali organizations that are basically trekking companies that are attracting teams to climb. It does take the focus off of them. And my personal opinion is that perhaps these trekking companies should organize amongst themselves as well too, and try and basically support restrictions and guidelines for those who should and shouldn't be on, you know, the highest mountain on the world. There's a lot of people who are dedicated sponsored climbers who have a lot of reservations about how Everest is managed, and not only the physical condition people are in to climb, but their climbing skills and ability. And when you get the traffic jams, and I think the media has shown a lot of photos of the traffic jams, quote unquote, that occur on Everest. And basically this puts a lot of people at risk, because if there's, you know, 300 people on a line waiting to summit Everest, that's a long time exposed to a hypoxic cold environment. And the potential for mass casualty is extremely high.
And of the proportion of people that you've ended up treating, what proportion are the Sherpa community and a kind of a local community, and what proportion were the people who travelled to get to the summit, and were there people who were there for other reasons, like journalists and documentary makers?
So I mentioned that there was 381 permits issued for Everest this year, but one of the things that we don't always hear is that supporting those largely Western clients are, you know, over 1,000 support staff. And that includes the climbing Sherpas, those that are fixing the ropes, the ice doctors, the camp staff, and the porters that are bringing up gear for everybody. So a huge, huge community of people supporting the climbers. And I think it pays to give that group recognition because they are often truly the unsung heroes in the Everest region. And I think I was happy to know that our clientele at the clinic was 3/4 Nepali. And so basically our service that we offer for the Nepali just has a token payment. So they pay very little to get what might be the only medical care that they might get for the whole year.
So it is a small village, or quite a large village, living in quite extreme conditions, and you are their you are their medical provider. It's not just the people you see in the papers who are trying to get to the top. So you're doing a good communal community service as well.
We do like to think so, and I think it's a mark of pride for us to know that we are hopefully contributing in a positive sense to the health and well-being of the people that are arguably working the hardest on the mountain.
And you've had to, for a few months, leave your family, leave your home, fly into an incredibly dangerous airport, trek up to a significant altitude, build a hospital, staff the hospital, deal with bureaucrats from one end of the spectrum to sick Sherpas at the other, and ST elevation MIs, severe head injury, and now you're heading home to New Zealand. Would you go back?
That's a great question. And because it's so fresh at the moment and everything is still settling down, I would have to give you a big maybe as an answer. I think it's been an incredible experience. I think it would be difficult to compare it to much else, even that I've done myself. But the decision to, like you said, pick up leave for 3 months away from those closest to you is incredibly challenging decision. You need that support around you for sure. And then to put yourself in a situation that's incredibly physically demanding. I mean, being basically, I would measure my sats regularly, and I don't think I've ever got about 90. So to be basically chronically hypoxic for 50 days, cold and dehydrated and coughing, in addition to practicing medicine and dealing sometimes with very high acuity cases with minimal equipment, stretches you in a lot of different directions at once. I think it's not a decision that people should take lightly. And I think even for me, I would have some second thoughts about going in. But in terms of an experience all around, second to none.
And just to reflect this back onto urgent care, we've covered some of the medical challenges that you faced, and certainly your training and the practicalities that urgent care brings you, and the broad scope of cases that you'll have come in contact with over your career. That served you in good stead. It's obviously served you in good stead to take that amount of leave from your clinic, because urgent care clinics continue working because we don't have patients that are assigned to us like a GP. We the doors open, and as long as the clinic is staffed, if Dr. Dinesh is going away for 3 months, then they just have to keep the clinic running. So certainly urgent care has enabled you to do this adventure that you've been on. And so if anybody was listening from the urgent care community, how would they start on a journey towards Everest?
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. And I think I'll just take a minute also just to thank those at my clinic. Obviously, if I do go away, they are the ones that do pick up the slack in terms of the work as well, too. And they've done a fantastic job being very supportive as well. Those at the urgent care clinic in Marlborough. It's a very good consideration. I mean, there is a good side and a bad side in having a clinic which is unscheduled episodic care, because you don't have to worry so much about the continuity care and the booked patients, but you do have to worry about the fact that the service itself does need to be covered continually. And I think people that are interested in it, probably would do well to choose carefully the duration and the types of activities that they would like to get involved with and understand what commitments would be required. Some of them, you do have to provide a reasonable amount of self-funding in order to do it. So that might affect your finances. Some of them will require a prolonged period. Obviously, like Everest does require almost a full 3 months commitment. So you have to have provisions in terms of leave and family and work in terms of how that might all come together. So in my case, it was a combination of accrued paid leave as well as an agreement to be on unpaid leave for a proportion of that time as well. So there are ways to work around it. I think it pays to front foot them, bring it to your organization as soon as you can in order for there to be as much lead up time in terms of rostering and provisions for the time away. But it shouldn't be something that discourages people either, because I think if you have a will, there's a way, like the old cliche says. I think that actually applies in this case.
And this is probably at the pinnacle of wilderness medicine to a certain degree, 3 months at high altitude. But there's a lot of wilderness things that people can do at weekends and you know, for shorter periods in maybe slightly less remote places to get a flavor for it. It sounds to me like this has been a culmination of your career in medicine, ending up at this Everest ER for this period.
It is. I guess I suppose in a way it's a metaphor for itself. So to finish at Everest does represent a pinnacle. For those that are interested, Everest ER does take a very long lead up time. In order for the selection process runs such that people need to have background in mountain medicine, wilderness medicine, have to have some expedition experience under their belt. They prefer to have people who have trained in the diploma in mountain medicine and preferably in Nepal as well. Then there'll be a requirement to work at a high altitude camp. And then there will be basically other factors like we discussed earlier about personality and fit and skills. So it's an incredibly long process for Everest ER. However, like you said, there are much more opportunities. I think people should always look in their own backyard. New Zealand, obviously, has fantastic mountains, have fantastic outdoor spaces. There are courses like the Advanced Wilderness Life Support course that people can get a taste for it, see if it's for them, as well as a lot of overseas wilderness emergency or wilderness extreme medicine conferences and Wilderness Medicine Society conferences overseas that people can take and you know, meet and discuss trips and possibilities and see if this is really for them.
And you've said maybe about going back to be at base camp as a doctor. Have you ever had an inkling to try and climb, be one of the 300 permits to climb Everest? Has that ever, as being there, has it tempted you?
It's always tempted. I grew up around the mountains myself in Canada. I've dabbled and had a taste. A part of my medicine training as well too involved ice climbing, rope work, and a lot of altitude traverses and glacier traverses. So I definitely have an appeal and an attraction to mountain, also in a recreational sense. However, I think seeing some of the extreme conditions and the expedition style climbing of a mountain like Everest, I wouldn't say it appeals to me strongly. It's something that I find fascinating, but I think I would have to have a much, much stronger desire for that style of expedition climbing in order to commit to something that's not only financially a big ask, it's also commitment away from family and friends. It's a commitment away from many, many things. So that in itself, I would have to say off the top, it's not something that strongly appeals to me, but I do find it something that's very, very fascinating.
But would you describe your experience of being at base camp? Do you get the feel for it as a very special place? Does it give, or do you feel that the volume of traffic has lessened the spiritual side of Everest? Has it been tarnished by the volumes of traffic from your position at the foot of the mountain? What did you feel?
I think it's definitely a concern. I think there is very strong issues that need to be addressed. I think fundamentally, the mountain and the area is a spiritual place, and I think that's sometimes forgotten, both perhaps by the Nepali government, with the fact that they like to attract foreign tourism to the area, but I think it can often be forgotten by the Western clients as well too. So I think there needs to be a little bit of a rethink around Everest and what's being done there. But in terms of the people and the camaraderie, starting first and foremost, like I mentioned, with the Sherpa people and their strength and endurance and tenacity, that I found very inspiring. I've met some tremendously impressive team leaders and guides as well. And that's been very impressive. And in addition to clients themselves, you know, all of them have different reasons for being there. I met a Nepali climber who I believe has summited now, who is HIV positive and was trying to climb in order to raise awareness for the HIV positive and AIDS community in Nepal, which still has a tremendous stigma, unlike other, for example, Western countries. I've met a Lebanese woman who summited as well, and she's just become the first Lebanese woman to do all 7 summits. So there's some very, very inspiring stories out there of people that you meet that have passed through the doors of Everest ER. So in a way, even without going much past the icefall, you can actually have a really very strong experience of Everest through the stories that actually come to you.
Now, I'm in awe of what you've done. I think hearing your stories, both the medical ones and just your personal experiences up on this mountain, it's a fascinating thing to hear your story and to get to see through your pictures and the video clips and hearing from you directly what it was like to be there. If people wanted to, is there a way that people can contribute to help this community there? Are there charities that people can donate to?
Definitely. There's a number of different organizations. I'll just mention a few which might be of interest. In particular, if people are interested in practicing Medicine Mountain and finding out more information, this would be a good starting point. And as I mentioned, the organization that I am employed by is entirely a Nepali-based NGO and voluntary. So that's the Himalayan Rescue Association, and they can be found at himalayanrescue.org.np. And there's also a community of interested medical doctors in Nepal who offer training, which is the Diploma of Mountain Medicine, and they can be found at the Mountain Medicine Society of Nepal, which is their website is mmsn.org.np. If people are interested as well, there is links to everester.org as well for more information, and the Facebook page will have posts about the season this year. And as well, I've included a bank link on my blog with Urgent Care, in which I will be collecting money in order to provide and purchase useful equipment for Everest ER so the other teams can benefit, kind of a legacy that will get paid forward. So people can refer to the rnzcuc.org.nz website, find the information at the bottom of my blog, and contribute in that way as well.
Yeah, so for those of us who may not physically make it there, we can at least help the provision of medicine in that area to not just, as you say, the people who have paid to climb the mountain, but to the community of Nepalese, the Sherpas, and the thousands of people who go into supporting that those people's endeavours. You can, as you say, there's a link on the college website where people can also read your entire series of blogs. You've read a few of them out for us, but they can read and see the photographs and get a feel for where you've been. But
indeed.
You're back to Marlborough, to wine country, the rolling hills of Marlborough, coming back to winter. So what's the weather like with you at the moment? What's Kathmandu like?
Well, right now I'm kind of holed up in my hotel room in Kathmandu, with my equipment scattered everywhere. It has to make it back into its bag. And I'll be in the taxi first thing in the morning. And the temperature here is about 25 degrees. And the partial pressure of oxygen, I can tell by with every breath, is much, much higher.
Cool. So you're coming back down to Earth. And then you'll be back in Marlborough at the urgent care clinic there, and back to normality. So I wish you safe travels, and thank you for chatting to our podcast, updating us. For those of you who want to hear more about your backstory, we'll link to the profile that we did. But this has been fascinating to see what your, how many days, 50 days you said, was it in total?
Yes, almost 50 days on the dot.
50 days in the Himalayas. So, safe travels, and thank you for a fascinating chat.
Thank you, Guy. Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. We all know the legend of Icarus. Countless have heard the myth recanted and have been reminded of the moral, that pride of flying too close to the sun, that thinly veiled teaching that ambition will outstrip the aspirant and they will fall. But maybe, just maybe, we have it wrong. Yes, Daedalus did warn his son not to fly too close to the sun, lest the wax holding his wings together should melt. And yes, we all know that this was in fact the cause of his demise. But we are quick to forget one thing. Daedalus also gave equal warning to his son not to fly too low, lest the sea mist dampen his wings and make it impossible to soar. This last warning, ignored by historians and moralists alike, strikes me as curious in the least. It pleads as much to the fact that the fate of the unambitious is no greater and no lesser than those who overreach. So reach. Whether your goal is to climb, to heal, to write, or just to marvel in the presence of grandeur, reach. Know where the limits above lie and below, but reach. Reach for challenge, reach for goals, for passion, for desires, for the things that fill our dreams. Reach for the opportunities in foreign lands, for love, for family, for that which you truly believe to be right. Reach for the snow in the highest parts of every realm. Reach for the rooftop of the world. Reach for Everest.